On this week's 51%, we're in the thick of football season, and we hear from the first woman to coach in the NFL.
There are still a lot of barriers when it comes to women in contact sports like that. It is an uphill climb.
Plus, we learn about an artificial pancreas from a woman who's an expert in type 1 diabetes. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Despite her 5'2", 130-pound frame, Jen Welter always excelled in athletics, from tennis to rugby to women's football. Welter credits her determination for helping to crack one of America's most stubborn glass ceilings. In 2015, she became the first female coach in the National Football League, working with the Arizona Cardinals linebackers in the preseason. But as Welter writes in her new memoir, Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless from the First Woman to Coach in the NFL, it took years of adversity before Welter found herself on the sidelines. Now she hopes her story can inspire others. And she spoke with 51%'s Ian Pickus all about it.
One thing you write about a lot in the book is that in sports, a lot of the opportunities that you had weren't necessarily in existence when you were growing up. I mean, it was hard to fathom a lot of the places you went and a lot of the leagues you played in and so forth. So when you were, let's say, in high school, what did you think your future in athletics would be?
You know, when I was in high school, in junior and senior year, I was a great soccer player. You know, I used to wear the number 13 as the sweeper because I said it was bad luck for them, right? Because they had to deal with me.
Right.
And I don't know why, but I didn't really understand that, you know, it wasn't like some coach was going to mysteriously find me and know I was this amazing soccer player and, like, a genie waves a magic wand and you get to go play soccer in college. And so I really thought that I would probably play soccer in college, and then that didn't happen. And so I ended up choosing to go to business school at Boston College and kind of putting my desire to play soccer to the back burner. And then I found this sport that I didn't even know existed, which was rugby, and immediately dove right in.
What was it that you liked about it?
It was football without the pads. It was, you know, it was football and soccer combined. So two sports that I had really loved. And this one, girls were allowed to play, you know, because football, it really wasn't. So it was the closest thing I had ever gotten to football. And as soon as I got my first taste of a tackle, that was pretty much it. I was done for.
Not too long after that, you ended up trying out for women's professional football. And if I was reading your book correctly, I mean, you were a little surprised that you made the team, right?
Well, I think with any of us, if we've been told or set a pattern in our life, you know, you kind of get used to getting turned down, or at least you fear it, right? And throughout my athletic career, though I was really good, I was always very undersized, you know, and when I was a tennis player, I was told that I'd never be pro because of my size and my build. And then as a rugby player, I got recruited for the under 23 national team, and then they told me I was too small. So stepping onto the football field, it was like, oh my gosh, here's this game that I have loved my whole life. And what if they tell me yet again that I'm too little? And so I struggled with it, like I think that we all do at times in our lives when we're stepping up into something or going to go for something that's so great. We fear rejection. And I certainly did, just like anybody else. And that fear could have kept me from trying out. Thankfully, the one thing that I told myself was I could live with being too small. I had been too small my entire life, but what I couldn't live with was wondering for the rest of my life what would have happened if I would have just tried out for that football team. And thankfully, that fear of always wondering motivated me enough to give it a try.
Well, we should say for our listeners who might be picturing a life of luxury in professional football that your check, your profit sharing check after winning a title was for $12. And a lot of the time you spent as a professional was trying to hustle just to make the games happen, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's the truth of women's football still to this day. The women playing are the pioneers in the game. You know, I could say we were a league of their own, like the classic baseball movie, but a league of their own seemed to be much better funded than we were. And it was just this love and this passion and this belief that we could play. I never once in my entire women's football career cashed a check for playing football. So it wasn't about that. And yet at the same time, the first check that I got was so valuable that I never cashed it. I kept it as a reminder of what we were doing and what we were all playing for, because that was a significant moment. It was the first time I'd ever been paid to play football. And so I always remember those things and try and keep them close, because you have to find value in your life by the standards that you set, right? I used to be afraid to tell little kids when I would go talk in schools, because, you know, I could show them that I was a four-time Super Bowl champion, and then they'd be like, oh my gosh, you know, if, you know, Tom Brady, before he won five, right, like, well, you must make, like, as much money as him. You make, like, $100 million, too, you know, and you kind of have to be like, no, that dollar, and you didn't want to, it was self-conscious to me at that point. And so what I finally came to is, you know, my value was priceless. Unfortunately, the budget was $12.
I mean, this is a very probably long answer, but why do you think the discrepancy is what it is?
Well, it's a younger sport in the history of sports, right? So it always takes time to get a foundation. But there are still a lot of barriers when it comes to women in contact sports like that. It is uphill climb. You know, it's only until recently that you saw like MMA accept women. It takes breakout performers to get the conversation started. I had so many people who would say, oh my gosh, Jen, I'm so sorry. I didn't even know women played football. So you can't be sorry for what you don't know. But once you do know, that's when you look at hopefully changing it. And we as a society can do that by continuing to share the stories, to, you know, change the narrative and to increase the opportunities and access, whether it's, you know, girls playing at younger and younger age, or putting women's sports on the same or similar, at least, platforms to men. Then you start to increase professionalism and the dollars happen as well.
We're talking with Jen Welter about her book, Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless, from the first woman to coach in the NFL. How did you get the job coaching in the league?
The way that I got the job in the NFL was actually a very long road, even though it seems so out of nowhere. I had played women's football for a good long time, and then I actually played a season of football against men in the indoor football league with the Texas Revolution. And what happened when I played on the Revolution is that it was so far out of the box that it really forced us all to come together, right? And we really did become very much a family. So we were very much a family, and a new head coach came in the next year, and I thought I was done, right? I survived playing against guys for a year. I did it. I don't need to test fate again. So he came in, and I just actually was at an event and walked in, and my guys flipped out, and they're, you know, tossing me around because relative to them, I'm a football. And it caught the head coach's attention because he said, who is this girl that all my guys love, right? And somebody told him, they're like, coach, that's your running back. And he was so surprised that the guys and I were so close that it made him curious. So he pulls me over, starts grilling me on football, what's good with the team, what's not, all of these things. And I just told him, you know, to me, it was like, well, I got to look out for these guys. And I told him what was good, what wasn't. And you know, probably was very opinionated. And he called me the next day and said, you have to coach my football team. And I said, absolutely not. I don't want to coach football. And he said, not a lot of guys are going to give you this opportunity. You're taking this job. And I said, no. And I hung up on him. So he called me back the next day and he told me about myself. He said, you remember how I said not a lot of guys were going to give you this opportunity and you were taking this job? And I said, yep. He said, good, I took it for you. You're coaching for me. And by the way, you can't quit. Otherwise, the narrative surrounding women in men's pro football would be, we had a girl once and she quit.
Hmm.
So I'm coaching in arena football and, you know, it's a cool experience, very different, but the NFL then announced Sarah Thomas as the first full-time female ref in NFL history. And in, you know, in response to Sarah's hiring, somebody asked Bruce Arians if he could ever see a female coaching in the NFL. And, you know, one of the things you got to love about Bruce Arians is he will tell you the truth, right? And so Bruce said, the second a woman can make these guys better, she'll be hired. And so I ended up talking to my coaches about it. And, you know, they said, well, we should call Bruce. And I thought they were all crazy. And they asked if I could get his number. And I kind of wondered about it because they had played in the NFL. And obviously I hadn't. But, you know, arena football, we practiced really early in the morning. And I just had way too much time on my hands that day. So I went on the website and looked up the Arizona Cardinals and found a number and called it. And on that day, I wasn't an assistant coach. I was an assistant. And I was calling the Arizona Cardinals on behalf of myself as if I wasn't myself. And worked my way to Bruce's assistant, who was fascinated. And he said, you know, I think Bruce would really want to take that call. And so I gave him the head coach's number. Definitely thought I had gotten blown off, but I was really proud of myself that I called. I felt like I'd kind of cheated the world, right? And I was really proud of myself that I was brave enough to get on the phone. And about 2 weeks later, I walked into practice, and my coach was just elated. And he said, you will never guess who I talked to yesterday. Bruce Arians. And he said, tell me about this girl.
Wow. These things usually break down in kind of predictable ways where there's a lot of noise on the sports shows and on the radio and so on. Some people are supportive, some aren't. At the time you were going through it, did you see yourself as the symbol that you became, or did you try to tune that stuff out?
I did my very best to tune all of that stuff out. I actually, when I got to training camp, you know, you kind of relax into a hotel room, and I went to turn on the TV, and the TV didn't work, and walk over, you know, like most people would do, pick up the phone and go to call the front desk. And then I thought, you know what? That's probably the best thing that could happen to me. I certainly don't need to hear it. So I kept the TV disconnected in my room, and really only heard about some of it when people would tell me, or, you know, the guys would tell me about stuff, or we'd be in a bar, but it really, not like a bar, but like watching football. And it just was when it resonated. But I just figured knowing all of that stuff couldn't really help me. It could only distract me. And what I needed to do was just put my head down and do the best job that I could, because my goal was always to be the first and not the last, meaning I wanted to be successful so that the door remained open for any woman who wanted to coach, not give them a reason to say, well, this is why it can't happen.
How far do you think we are from having a head coach in the NFL who's a woman?
You know, I think that'll be a while only, and not for any reason of like gender bias or any of those things, but because it takes a really long time to get the experience necessary to be a head coach in the NFL, you know, and women are just now getting opportunities to join staffs, and we still need to get more women involved in college. Now, there are some great women who coach in high schools and in women's football as well. But I think it's going to take some time and really being in that system and in that world to not only, you know, have all of the experience, but also to have been around the league enough to know all of the players, because that's a lot of it. And I don't just mean the football players on the field, but I mean, you know, the deal makers and the front offices and all of those interconnected things that happen. So I think that you'll see it in the NBA, you know, with either Nancy Lieberman or a Becky Hammon before you will the NFL, because it just typically is a longer career path.
Well, one of the things you hear when any of these barriers is broken is that, oh, well, you know, the players will tune her out. She won't be able to go into the locker room. They're not going to want to, you know, get yelled at by a woman. You didn't really find that any of that was true in practice, right?
No, actually, I thought it was a good addition to a great staff, meaning, you know, every coach is just looking at a facet of the game, and hopefully together as a staff, we relate to the players well as a whole, right? A lot of these guys really took to it, you know, and what I figured out, and it really just came from the fact that we became really close, is that, you know, they wanted me to meet their moms. And whether it was a mom or an auntie or a grandma who was that really significant, strong woman in their life, a lot of them came from a single caregiver household, and that was a strong woman. So a good amount of those guys had been being coached by women their whole lives, just maybe not in the NFL. And so I think that you just have to look at it, and you don't want it to be the same, right? I tell people all the time, I was like, you know, I didn't coach the same way as the guys because I'm not the guys. And it's not a value for me to try and outman a man at being a man. Like, what I or any woman brings to a situation should be unique and special. That's why we have diversity, right? Like, I had a doctorate in psychology. So that was something that I could add to the staff that was unique to my background. And so there were areas that I could relate in that. And I think that's where we're a little misguided, is it's like, well, you know, it's him getting coached by a woman as opposed to a man. Well, no, it's being coached by men and women. And, you know, on some things the guys might be better, and on another, you know, a woman might add some value or be better. So I loved it, and I think the guys would tell you the same thing.
Do you see yourself getting back to the NFL someday? Do you still want to coach there?
I love coaching football, and I coach football all the time. I'm just not coaching in the NFL, so that remains to be seen. I think the hard thing for me is, you know, I loved all the players and coaches in Arizona so much that I have a very hard, like a very high bar that it would be to step back into. But we'll see.
That was Jen Welter speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. Welter is the author of Play Big, Lessons in Being Limitless from the First Woman to Coach in the NFL. Doctors often suggest managing diabetes through diet and exercise, but that's primarily for type 2 diabetes. Those who suffer from type 1 diabetes can only manage their disease with the help of medicine. The University of Virginia recently pledged $17 million to research new interventions for type 1 diabetes, including support for an artificial pancreas. Allison Quance has the details.
Let's start with the basics of diabetes, because they can be confusing. Type 1 diabetes means that your pancreas does not produce insulin. Insulin is what helps our bodies use glucose as energy. So if you're not producing insulin, glucose just builds up in your blood, causing dangerously high blood sugar. For people with type 1 diabetes, there are usually two main steps to managing the disease. The first step is monitoring your blood sugar levels.
To figure out what's happening with your blood sugar, we have what we call sensors, and they detect what someone's blood sugar is doing.
This is Sue Brown, a professor at the University of Virginia School of Medicine and an expert in type 1 diabetes. After you've determined your blood sugar level, you have to make adjustments. If it's high, meaning you don't have enough insulin in your body, you'd inject yourself with insulin.
So to deliver the insulin, they have something called an insulin pump. And those are devices that are available that deliver the insulin to someone under their skin.
If your blood sugar is low, you've given yourself too much insulin already, and you want to lower that dose and maybe eat something to bring up your levels. It sounds like a fairly simple equation. High blood sugar, less insulin. Low blood sugar, use that pump to inject more insulin. Voila. But it's not that simple. All kinds of things influence your blood sugar. Predicting how food will affect levels is hard enough, but activity, exercise, stress, and how much sleep you've gotten, they all mess with that equation too, which means there's a lot of guesswork involved.
They have to constantly try and manage and figure out how much insulin do I need for all those activities I'm doing on any given day.
This is where the artificial pancreas comes in.
So what an artificial pancreas does is help figure out how much insulin do I need right now. It can make automated adjustments on, oh, I see you're going to get low, we better lower your insulin.
In other words, researchers took the existing separate technologies, monitors for blood sugar level and pumps to give insulin, and figured out a way to make them talk to each other. Boris Kovachev is director of UVA's Center for Diabetes Technology. Here's how he puts it.
At UVA, what we are focusing on is on the brain between the sensor and the pump. It's not entirely a substitute to biological pancreas, but it's trying to be as close as possible to the real thing.
You might not realize how big of a deal this system is, but for a lot of people with diabetes, it can be revolutionary. Think about it from the perspective of a parent whose kid has type 1 diabetes.
I think if you ask a parent of a child who has type 1, they pretty much don't sleep night after night.
Your blood sugar doesn't stop fluctuating when you sleep, which means that constant monitoring and adjusting can't either.
They're worried about getting up, checking the blood sugar, seeing where it's going, and these automated systems really help take that burden off.
Brown says the responses from people who are using UVA's artificial pancreas in clinical trials are overwhelming.
I can't tell you the number of times that we finish a study, they've been able to have access to the artificial pancreas, and now it's time to give it back. And at that moment, parents, kids, adults are oftentimes in tears because it made such a difference to them, and they just want to figure out, how can I have this in my future?
Fortunately, for some type 1 patients, the future is now. Brown says that while UVA's new system isn't available quite yet, she's already prescribing a different artificial pancreas in her clinic. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
November 6th was an especially important date in women's history. It marked the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in New York, which passed 3 years before the 19th Amendment granted women the right to vote nationwide. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul announced on that date that in honor of the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage in New York, the state would dedicate and build two statues in commemoration of suffragists Sojourner Truth and Rosalie Gardner Jones. They also proclaim November 2017 Women's Suffrage Centennial Month. Meanwhile, there are 23 statues of historical figures in New York City's Central Park, but not one honors a woman. So the campaign is on to place the first statue honoring women's history in Central Park. The Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony Statue Fund is the nonprofit all-volunteer organization dedicated to the effort. And with support from the New York City Parks Department and the Central Park Conservancy, the statue site will be near the West 77th Street entrance to Central Park. That's a location across from the New York Historical Society and the American Museum of Natural History, and it will ensure that many of Central Park's 42 million annual visitors become more aware of women's contributions to history. The Statue Fund is working to raise the $1.5 million needed to commission, install, and maintain the statue. The goal? Bring monumental women to Central Park. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1478.